Hi, I'm Nirav Desai.
And I'm Kirby Shibaga. Vinay may be meeting us later today, and we have Stephen in the background helping us out. Today, we have some special guests on our show. We have Joe Ludwig and Forrest Gibson. And the reason I asked them on the show a few weeks ago, I noticed that there was a hackathon occurring, obviously a virtual hackathon. The topic itself was very interesting. Think of it as AR within VR. And I'm sure they'll explain it much better than I just did with that short example. So let's get started. Joe, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I've been working on VR, I guess, for my day job for the last 8 years or so. Did a bunch of work on Steam VR and Team Fortress 2. I've worked on the HTC Vive from the software side. And then the Index after that, and just have been, you know, ongoing efforts to work on the platform side of VR. And more recently, I've been working on this project, Aardvark, which is a platform for building AR tools or gadgets, as they're sort of called in Aardvark nomenclature, on top of VR experiences.
Thank you. And how about you, Forrest?
I've been working on VR for about 8 years now as well, and really been focused around what it means to feel present with other people, this connection that we call shared presence, where you're able to share the feeling of being in the same virtual space as other people. And that's really where my focus has been. And with Pluto VR, and our purpose as a company is to help humanity transcend physical location, really focusing on kind of connection, collaboration, and communication.
So you mentioned this project called Aardvark, and I did notice, I went to GitHub, had a quick look at it. It started up, some time ago, and it looks like it's gotten recent activity and excitement from the community. Can you talk about the hackathon and how that went?
So a few weeks ago, we declared Aardvark to be alpha, which is just sort of an announcement more than any particular threshold. There's no official definition of that. And as part of that, we scheduled a hackathon for a couple of weeks later. That happened last weekend. And the goal of that hackathon was to start to get more people involved in the project, get them building gadgets, get them to give us feedback about how, you know, what worked there and what didn't, and what direction we needed to go in with the platform. So, because of COVID, obviously, that needed to be a virtual hackathon. And a couple of folks from Pluto really helped out a bunch setting that up. I personally have very little experience either running or attending hackathons. So Forrest will probably talk more about the hackathon side than I will. But it was a great experience. You know, I spent the weekend with, I think we had 50 people register. And probably about half that actually showed up on the first day, and I think we're down to about 10 by Sunday afternoon. But it was still a tremendous amount of feedback, and lots of, you know, interesting, useful stuff happened over the course of the weekend.
Fantastic.
So, Joe and Forrest, I know you, Pluto's been a great contributor to the community in Seattle, so appreciate that. I definitely want to dive in a little bit more about the hackathon, but Kirby, I thought before we dive into that, I'd like to know a little bit more about Project Aardvark, as well as, Joe, you said a very interesting thing, which is AR in VR. And can you explain a little bit more what that actually means and what that looks like?
So augmented reality is, you know, when I think of augmented reality, I think of Rainbow's End, where there are these belief circles, I think they're called, in Rainbow's End, where you essentially provide content, or the technology provides content that you see over the real world, and as you're moving around in the real world, the stuff does whatever it needs to do. It could be virtual people, it could be information about people, it could be information about places, it could be completely artificial, you know, environments or whatever. That's a really hard thing to do, and augmented reality over the real world is not very far along. There are some hardware projects out there that, like, say, HoloLens or Magic Leap, where you can do it, but the field of view is pretty narrow, the displays aren't that bright, and they have some fundamental limitations, like the inability to draw the color black, for instance, because they can only add light to the scene. So on the display side and on the deployment side, running augmented reality over the real world is very difficult. Running augmented reality over the virtual world, however, is much more straightforward. VR displays over the last, I guess the Oculus Kickstarter was 8 years ago, 1 month ago, right? It was in August 2012, so we just passed it. And in that amount of time, VR displays have just gotten so much better. And with Index and Reverb G2 coming out shortly, they're very high quality VR displays that are widely deployed. Lots of people have access to them. And when you're building an AR experience where you're doing the same sorts of augmentations, but you're doing it over a virtual space, a lot of those problems go away. You have a wide field of view display. You have brightness. You can draw whatever color you want. And in many cases, you can also gain scene understanding, not from understanding the scene, but from taking advantage of the fact that the thing that you're looking at is artificial to begin with. So that artificial scene can then feed back into the system, at least theoretically, and allow you to augment it more in a more straightforward way than you can over the real world. So by doing this, what you're doing is prototyping augmented reality experiences that might be 10 or 20 years away mm-hmm. in the real world, today in the virtual world. And by the time that the real world displays catch up, where you can have a pair of Ray-Bans or whatever that you run around in the park with that give you that Rainbow's End experience, you've been doing it in VR for 10 or 20 years, and a lot of those same tools will just port straight over and work fine.
Interesting. So would you say then it's more than just for testing, right? And prototyping, is it something that you're using right now in terms of applications for current use, or is it really more further reach looking?
It's a little of both. I think that there are a lot of interesting gadgets to be built and a lot of valuable stuff to be built that will serve people who want to run it over VR. So I think that there's a need for these kinds of overlay applications in VR experiences that has not been especially well served. There are overlays in SteamVR, but they're pretty limited. And I wanted to not only make them a little less limited, but also make it easier to create them. Make them more interactive with each other, so Aardvark gadgets can communicate with each other, even if they're from different authors, and make them much more multi-user, so that they'll be inherently tools that, if the five of us were together in an Aardvark session, then we could see what each other is doing and share some of those tools, work together on collaborative stuff, or share a quest guide or whatever in a VR game that we're playing. And so I think we can provide that value now. And by the time that AR displays show up, the VR displays will already, they'll have been off and running for a long time at that point. So it's not so much about prototyping, it's more about getting that functionality earlier in the venue in which we can get it, and then, eventually expanding to be everywhere.
One way that we see that, addition to the AR and VR concept, is this idea of, multi-applications. VR has been very much in the world of similar to DOS, where you can run one application at a time, and you're pretty limited to the scene app. And there have been some overlay apps, and Pluto was one of the kind of early overlay apps in the SteamVR ecosystem. But we really see it as this power of a full computing system. So once you can start running multiple applications at the same time, new emergent behaviors can start to form. So Pluto is a communications app. It runs alongside other things. Right now, we're on Teams, but we can also have Google Docs open, right? You didn't have to close Teams to then open up Google Docs. And we're starting to see that with these gadgets and Aardvark as well, where now, I can have a boombox where I can play music, and then I can also have cards where I can play cards with other friends, and then I could also have maybe my desktop windows or other things like that all around me. And so it creates this kind of more complete computing ecosystem in a way in which multiple developers are actually working on each piece of it, as opposed to it all being by one single monolithic provider.
There's been a tendency to try to build everything into that base level application, whatever that experience is. And what that means is that almost nothing gets built because most of that interesting stuff is not actually, it doesn't have a big enough audience, or it's not, you know, doesn't bubble to the top of the list for that base level app to build. And so splitting those two things out, splitting the things out that need to cross multiple apps. So you run it in BeatSaver, you run it in Rec Room, or you run it in Skyrim, or whatever the base game is that you're playing, means that not only does that one thing get a bigger audience because it's divided among everybody no matter what they're playing, but it also means that things that are much more a niche experience or a niche tool are still worth doing because somebody can just do it and they don't need permission from the person who made the base app or any sort of platform holder to do that. It's just an open, you know, ecosystem where they can build whatever they think is important. And in a lot of cases, those things won't turn out to be used by very many people. But in other cases, hopefully they will. And you know, a lot of utility will be given to those people who are using those new tools.
So I really like the way Forrest described that, you know, going from DOS, just running one program, to today where we can have all these apps running at the same time and we get utility from them. We can integrate and share all of that. The thing that sounds really cool here is that if, say, the four of us are all in VR, we don't actually have to be in the same application, as you said. So we could all be in our own home or playing a game or whatever it is. But yet we can share one of these gadgets. So we'll see a physical, a 3D model of the gadget in our room, in our space, but we won't see each other. Is that correct?
It sort of depends on what all you're running. Pluto will certainly let you see each other if you're sharing, if you're in a call together. And perhaps at some point, you know, Aardvark will grow some gadgets that provide avatars for users. There's nothing built into Aardvark that is about avatars, but you can attach things to people's bodies, so then those are avatars. So we'll see what people come up with in terms of that side of the system. But I would expect there to be at least some kind of representation of the other users that you're in any sort of multi-user scenario with.
I see it as a large gradient, right? So you could be collaborating with someone on a Google Doc and not be on a call with them, right? You could just have a Google Doc open and you could be writing in it, doing your own thing, and you're collaborating together. You might share the same audio feed. So maybe you want to be in, you know, listening to the same kind of radio station or virtual radio station and still not necessarily want that connection, but then being able to seamlessly turn that connection on and then be there right next to them. So I could see scenarios where you'd want to be fully present, right? Entirely immersed. You see the other people that are there with you, all the way to maybe just the audio, and then maybe just, you know, they're ghosts and you barely see them at all. And I can see the whole gradient of value there.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I kind of liken it to the early days of the internet where we all had our little AOL instant messaging video or app running in the background. And we could reach out. I mean, clearly there's lots of platform for that now, but fascinating.
So some of the technology involved, you know, I had a very quick look at the repository, cloned it, and was playing around a little bit this morning. Forrest, what are the main components here? And if, you know, as a developer, what kind of skills do you need to take advantage of the project?
Well, I mean, I feel like that's more of a Joe question. I am much less deep in the technical workings of Aardvark.
Okay.
So Aardvark is essentially a web browser. Each gadget runs as a tab, more or less. Uses underlying all of that is a library called Ceph or Chromium Embedded Framework. It's basically a repackaging of the Chromium browser in a way that can be embedded in other applications. So it uses Ceph and runs these gadgets as browser tabs, meaning they're isolated from each other in their execution environments, and also that they're downloaded from the internet. There's no deployment, there's no install. On the client side, it's just you give someone a URL, they favorite that thing, they open the gadget in Aardvark, and they're running the gadget. On on top of that, on top of that sort of basic web stack, it uses currently uses React to generate a scene graph that provides the you know the 3D spatial representation of whatever the gadget is displayed as. Then and also the interactive elements there, so the things you click on or grab or move around or whatever.
So, the web is this actually WebXR part of the? Is it using any of the API from W3C?
It's using a lot of API from W3C. It's not using WebXR specifically. My sense is that WebXR is appropriate for some applications but not appropriate for the sort of like lightweight tools that travel with you across VR applications. And I think that for a couple of reasons. It's really hard to get things to run at frame rate on a headset. I guess the sort of baseline standard frame rate for VR headsets on a PC is 90 frames a second, 0.11 milliseconds that you have to render each frame. And if in that amount of time, you have to go to every single gadget and they have to run some code every 11.11 milliseconds, it's going to be very difficult to get all of that stuff to run, and also the game that you're running on top of, all at the same time, every frame to generate those frames. So the artwork approach is much more declarative. What the gadget says is, draw this stuff for me. Draw this model over here. Draw this this 2D panel over here. Make this thing be a button. And as those things are described through the scene graph, they're parented to devices, or they're parented to the world, and they're even transformed beyond that in some ways. But all you say when you say draw a model is, here's the URL to my model. And that could be an HTTP URL or an IPFS URL if it's something more dynamic. And you take that model and then it renders in the artwork renderer, which you know does need to run a frame rate. And what this means is the gadgets can run much more slowly. The gadgets can run at 10 frames a second, or can update when they actually change, as opposed to you know needing to run every frame. And that matches more closely with the way that layout and CSS and HTML and the DOM work in the web browser, where the DOM traversal and the layout engine in the web browser is not written in JavaScript. It's written in C++. It's you know highly optimized. It's very finely tuned, because that's where all the performance comes out in the web browser. And so what Aardvark is attempting to do is to basically do the same thing for 3D spatial interfaces, 3D spatial experiences, by allowing the JavaScript to say, draw stuff, and then the actual drawing of stuff happens in a lower level that will run at frame rate.
This feels like the future of how systems are going to have to work, because expecting that every individual developer has, you know, worked on their application to the point where they're kind of guaranteeing they're able to hit frame rate, because, you know, not hitting frame rate is such a significant impact on the user experience. And that while there's a lot of great work that's been done to sort of, you know, the asynchronous time warp and space warp to try to blend the images and make them work, or even, you know, kind of interpolating the frames so you can be running at half frame rate, this declarative model where you can just say, here's a 3D model, render this, it seems to be the way that this has to go. And similar to what Joe said around how the web works, like you just can't expect every individual developer to be managing this all themselves.
So it's more like A-frame in that sense, being declarative.
So I'm not super familiar with A-frame, but as I understand A-frame, it's like the top end of A-frame. A-frame itself, I think, doesn't A-frame run on 3JS?
Yeah.
So A-frame runs on the top of 3JS, which is also written in JavaScript and uses WebGL and other sorts of web tech to generate the actual pixels. So it's sort of the piece above that. It's you take the pieces that are going into 3JS and you render them somewhere else in a big combined rendering process from all the gadgets. And that's the only thing that needs to run at frame rate.
So Forrest, with Pluto VR and the mission of the company, what are some of the gadgets that you find people will want to use first?
You know, when we started Pluto, we had our purpose, but we didn't know exactly what we were going to be doing. And so we went through iterations of just about everything you could imagine, from physics playrooms where you could throw balls and catch balls together, you know, card games, poker, collaborative couch gaming, shared viewing of movies and things like that, whiteboards, business collaboration. And we built prototypes of all of these things. And every time we did that, we kept looking and saying, well, to make this prototype into something usable, an actual product, we're going to have to spend, you know, we're going to have to focus the whole company into doing this and become a blank company, right? A board game company or a virtual rec room kind of company. But we kept saying, well, really, what's the theme between all those things? It's the people. And so with the Aardvark gadgets, what's so exciting, you know, the hackathon project that I worked on was cards, was playing cards. It's a deck of cards that you could draw cards from and then hand them around and use them as cards, right? That's an incredibly powerful tool when you think about what do humans do when they're sitting around bored together. Well, sometimes they pull out cards and they play cards together. Whiteboard is one of the default apps that Joe has made. You know, whiteboards are incredibly powerful tools for sharing writing among a group of people. You know, I think screens, the thing that a lot of people don't necessarily think when they think of this future augmented reality world, the power of just having two-dimensional screens that you can summon without having to have an extra monitor, it's incredibly powerful. And, you know, there's early work on this in Aardvark, the ability to pull in individual windows from your desktop. And at the point at which those can then be shared, that's, you know, take all of the power of computers and then just be able to seamlessly share that with other people in a very controlled way around your privacy, as well as an infinitely possible way where you can just start summoning and throwing out windows that you don't have to have a bunch of monitors.
That's extremely powerful when we're thinking about use cases around the future of work, particularly as the office transitions into spatial tech. Clearly, everyone's going to be using their own line of business application for whatever they need to do, but that collaboration side would kind of span across all those applications. Sorry, I'm just thinking out loud. This is a... really interesting.
I think what we're trying to do with Aardvark is to start to provide that platform. Right now, there's no API that you can write to. There's no system you can write to that will allow you to do these collaborative sorts of things that doesn't expect to own every pixel that your eyes are going to see. And Aardvark is trying to fill in that gap where it doesn't think that every Aardvark gadget is going to control every pixel. It's going to control, you know, some subset as you interact with that thing, and then it's going to go away and get out of your way when you go to interact with something else. Just like, you know, you have multiple tabs on your taskbar on Windows, on your desktop. And so that is a missing piece right now in VR, and that's you know, sort of what we're trying to aim at. You both have mentioned screens, and that's screens are great. Like, I'm a big fan of screens. I wish I had like 10 more, because there are a lot of things where I'd like to just put up a screen and have a window on it that I rarely look at. But when I need it, I just, you know, turn my head and there it is.
Right.
And that's something you can do in VR. But to a certain extent, screens are, they're a legacy approach to a lot of these things. So there are numerous examples of a transition in, you know, from one medium to another, where, for instance, when television first started, people would sit together at a table and read radio plays on television, because that was what people understood. Radio plays were an understood thing. They were popular. People liked them. So they just did that on TV. And it took a while before they figured out that, you know, TV can do other things. You can actually have people acting out the radio plays. And even beyond that, it took a long time before they figured out that, you know, they developed the language of this kind of wipe or fade or whatever, or this close-up means this thing, and the formats of, you know, exactly how you do all those things. And they had to build that in collaboration with the audiences themselves, as the audiences were leveling up to understand what those things meant also. So we're just at the very beginning of that with VR and AR, and we have a lot of figuring out to do to figure out what that language is. And I suspect that a lot of what we're seeing right now in screens is going to move into something else eventually. It's not going to be a flat screen in the long run. But in the short run, providing that bridge to flat screens, we take the richness of the last, 30, 40 years of building personal computer applications and make them work in VR and AR until we can develop more native experiences.
True, we went through a whole decade of the 70s of the Star Wipe, so looking forward to moving beyond the screen. That's interesting. Yeah, I've spoken to a number of companies looking at data analytics in VR, and particularly when you're talking about 3D data sets like geospatial data or graph data, it's really not about the screen. Right? We just present that data in the screen because that's what we're used to.
Yeah, the WIMP interface, what Windows icons, menus, and pointers interface, has been around for a long time, and it's pretty long in the tooth. And some of what we've seen on mobile is sort of moving beyond that. But that's more because of the limitation of the minimum screen size and the fact that you cover up the screen when you interact with it, when you touch it with your finger. VR has its own sets of limitations, which right now include, relatively low angular resolution for the displays. So you can't quite pack as many pixels in as you can on a desktop monitor or on a phone, especially. Phones are extremely high resolution given the angle that they subtend in your vision. But we really haven't moved beyond desktop interfaces yet. And so that's, I think something that we're just going to do as we transition things into VR.
So I kind of, like Nerv said, I started with the wrong question about hackathons before we actually got to the definition of aardvark and gadgets. So Forrest, how did you and Joe meet, and how did you organize the hackathon, and how did it end up?
I'm trying to think of the first time we met. I mean, we've been running in the similar VR circles. I got a chance to go and experience some of the early VR experiences that Valve had put on. And, I think it was through Aardvark primarily that Jared Cheshire, one of the other co-founders of Pluto, has been collaborating pretty tightly with Joe on Aardvark and providing a lot of feedback and kind of contributing from Pluto's angle. And then now that it's gotten into alpha, thinking that it's a good time to get it out into more people's hands. And this isn't the first hackathon we've done, but this is kind of the first public one that happened. So really getting a chance to get this out into the world, and especially in a time where people are starting to feel challenged by the state of virtual reality and sort of the control of platforms that are getting put onto this, having an open platform where people can start to build their own things and to kind of create these more robust multi-app experiences, is really something we want to get out there into people's hands and to have them start building themselves.
One of the things that seemed to surprise some of the teams of the hackathon was that the publishing step was just uploading the new gadget build to the web page, to the web server. Like, it's a web page. Like, it downloads it from the web. It runs it just like it would run any other JavaScript in any other web page. And that's very different than how VR apps have been delivered, more traditionally up to this point, where it's a bigger install and has to run native code locally. So it's. I'm hoping that will accelerate the rate of innovation as people, can iterate much more quickly.
I was fully aware of that, and I was still blown away by the experience. Right. So I was working on the cards team, and the Cardvark team, and we just we published our first build, and then Joe said, "Hey, I'm going to toss it in the Labs tab here," and he did, and then we could just suddenly open it, and it was the fastest deployment process I've ever experienced with anything VR. And because it was all distributed via the web, all of us had access to it at the same time. And it was phenomenal. And that kind of iteration loop where, much like a browser tab, you can make a change, push a change, and then open up the updated version. So you can actually have the previous version of your gadget, make a change, and then open up the new version, much like you'd open up a new tab on your web browser. And you can actually compare the difference between the changes you made, because the old one is still running. And so it's this really interesting, you can't do that in other VR experiences where you have your previous VR experience and then open up your modified one and then see them both and compare them next to each other.
Forrest, can you go through how that actually works in VR? What does that look like? Let's say I'm working on a game, right? And I update the, tell me if this is a bad example, because I'm just trying to get a visual of it. I update the skin for the zombie. And I want to look at it or update the environment, that the room I'm in. Is that what you're talking about, or am I picturing that wrong?
So I'm going to give the actual, I'm going to give the specific example around cards, because, you know, it's a deck of cards. So I was primarily responsible at the time for designing all the cards and making the system there. So I would make a change to the cards. So I'd change the card back, and then I could push that change, and then we could deploy it. And now I could still have the old version of the cards, so I could see the card back, which I got feedback saying it was too visually noisy. And then I could pull out the new version and now see the new one that's updated. And I could actually hold them next to each other and compare them. Imagine you're designing a physical deck of cards. You do your first print, and then you make some changes, and then you do your second print, and then you can hold them next to each other. It just happens to be virtual, not physical.
Within a existing application, but kind of the way I took what you were saying is that you could actually switch between applications rather quickly as well? Is that, or am I misunderstanding?
So the reason that I didn't call them applications is I didn't want to give the impression that they were all-encompassing. Mobile apps take up your whole screen. Most apps in on the desktop really seem to want to be the maximized, taking up a whole monitor. Zoom, every time I run, it makes itself full screen, and then make it not full screen, and then makes itself full screen 2 seconds later for no reason I can tell. Everybody wants to be full screen. Aardvark gadgets do not want to be full screen. The deck of cards that Forrest is describing is a thing that you're holding in your hand. So you can move it around. You can hit the button to pull a new card out. You can then pick up that card and move it around. But most of your field of view, especially if you turn around, is not taken up by that deck of cards. And that's true for all Aardvark gadgets. And any of those gadgets, it's a pre-existing gadget, but you could write a new deck of cards and bring it up next to the existing deck of cards while that existing deck of cards is standing there. And you could look completely differently. The success case for Aardvark, I think, is somewhat like the success case for the web, where if you look for websites where you can play cards, I haven't actually done this, but I suspect the number is quite large. They all look different. They all have different rules. And that's good. That means that the users can vote with their feet, and they can prefer to go to this use this gadget or that gadget because they like the way that it looks or like the way that it works, and or they like, you know, how much it costs or whatever it is they're using to discern, you know, which one is better. That's up to the users, and that's a good thing.
So in the context of a hackathon, that's actually really fascinating because you can provide the attendees, I'm thinking about in terms of a business hackathon, a set of tools that they can use to prototype business applications, or what I gather from this past hackathon, it was really more about building those gadgets, correct?
It's entirely about building gadgets.
Gotcha.
And I would expect that a lot of business applications would also be gadgets.
Yeah.
They would just be gadgets that have a more serious bent than, you know, playing cards or the boombox, you know, or the emoji gadget, which were a few that were being developed during that.
One way that I can imagine the progression happening is right now we're in the alpha phase where there's still the fundamental gadgets that need to be built, right? There, previously to the hackathon, there were no cards, no deck of cards. Now there is a deck of cards. But once you start piling these things up and you get that diversity of gadgets, there's, you know, 5 whiteboards to choose from. There's 5 different note-taking tools. People made conference tables because sometimes people want to have a place to set other things. Once those things start piling up and you have this big pile of gadgets you can choose from, I think the business hackathon example is, hey, here's 100 gadgets to play with, and now you can prototype and build business use cases using a variety of gadgets. So maybe there's a gadget that is I hate that I'm saying this, but, you know, a PowerPoint presentation gadget in which you can take PowerPoints and you can present them. Really, yep. It should be a new 3-dimensional version, but maybe someone wants 2D slides still. There's the laser pointer, because when they're doing their presentation, they want to point on the presentation where it is. The presentation app and the laser pointer gadgets, presentation gadget and the laser pointer gadget are separate tools developed by separate people, and the user gets to decide which one that they choose.
So an example, I guess there are a few examples of that, of things Forrest just said. There is a whiteboard gadget. It is a very simple whiteboard. It is a tool for me to use to further develop Aardvark itself, more than it's a user-friendly whiteboard that two people would really want to collaborate around. And what that allowed me to develop was a lot of the verbs that other gadgets can use. So the whiteboard is multi-user. If you're on a Pluto call with someone else, you can both see the same whiteboard. You can both draw on the whiteboard. You see what the other person draws. But that whiteboard doesn't have an eraser. The only way to erase anything on the whiteboard is to destroy the whiteboard and make a new whiteboard, which thankfully is free. You don't have to go to Office Depot. You can just make a new whiteboard out of thin air. But there's no eraser. At some point, if whiteboards are a thing that's useful to people, then somebody's going to make a whiteboard that is actually like trying to be functional as opposed to trying to be a good test case for what it's like to develop gadgets. And that whiteboard will completely obliterate, in terms of functionality, the whiteboard that's built in, because I'm not going to spend a lot of time making the whiteboard that's built in be the best whiteboard that could ever be a whiteboard. And I'm looking forward to that day because I'd like to have a nice whiteboard app.
That makes sense. It's really kind of opening up a marketplace for people to build on top of the platform.
Or better yet, not a marketplace because it's just a URL.
Well, it's a marketplace for people's time and attention. Whether or not it's a marketplace for commerce, and I think eventually, in the successful end state for Aardvark, there's plenty of commerce going on. People are moving money around, trading money for goods and services. But that's up to the individual gadget authors. They don't have to charge for their thing if they don't want to. But in the short run, it's very much a marketplace for attention and development time and people's investment of their own hours of the day. And that's really one of the challenges when you're at this phase and this sort of project, is that you need people to make gadgets so that there are things for people to use when they come try to use the platform. And that causes there to be more users, which then causes there to be more of a set of people who are going to use your gadget when you make a gadget. So getting that flywheel up and running is the main thing that we have to do right now. Like that's the task right now. Get to the point where everybody who runs VR wants to download and install this thing because it has the whatever that is useful to them. And it's probably going to be multiple whatevers. It's not going to be one thing for all people. But there are enough overlapping things that they're happy to run it. And then once they're happy to run it, then it's easier to make useful and overlapping things.
So if a developer wants to create a gadget, what kind of skills do they need right now?
It's written in TypeScript and React typically right now. So those are useful skills if you already happen to have them. There are also relatively easy skills to build if you have just general programming skills. And that's on the programming side. There are a lot of other useful things that you could do on the art side, on writing, sound, like graphic design. There are a lot of skills that are not typing out code that would be very valuable when it comes to building an Aardvark gadget that you could see, you can see the difference between the Cardvark that came out of the hackathon and the whiteboard, for instance. The whiteboard is made out of platonic solids because I'm not an artist. And so I made it out of boxes that I scaled to be, vaguely the right size, and cylinders and spheres. And Cardvark has an actual model for a deck of cards. It has an actual card model for I don't know if they're rounded at the moment, but what a card looks like. It has actual art for the card back and for the card front. And getting those skills from a more varied set of people, I think will be a significant boost to the quality of the gadgets that people are running.
So speaking of the models that you can bring in, I think it's GLTF. There's not support for like FBX or something like that, or?
No, that's right, it's GLTF. There are a lot of the standards for models that are meant to be consumed at runtime are very strange. GLTF is one of the first ones that's actually an open standard that is meant to be used at runtime. FBX is more for transferring model data between back back-end tools, like tools that are used to edit the models, mm-hmm. where GLTF is very much like, okay, you have your model, now go draw it. And there are some other formats that are reasonably appropriate for that, like OBJ, that are not open standards. They just are easy enough that a lot of people have implemented them in a lot of ways, but there's not really a standard for it. And it'll be a OBJ's case. It's owned by somebody, I'm not sure who. So I picked GLTF because I've been working with Konos a bunch on OpenXR, and because I just thought it was a emerging format that had a lot of support. And since then, the support seems to have gone up. So it seems like it was a reasonable choice.
During the hackathon, then, you did have participation from different walks of life. Like you mentioned, you had, you know, Forrest working on models, and you had, I guess, Jared doing some coding. Did you have any business people there? I'm just curious, like looking at opportunities for this technology.
I don't think there were a lot of business focused. I mean, this is the, you know, the reminder of the time we're at, and Aardvark just turned into alpha. So this is still a very technical, it's still at a very technical phase where there's still a lot of exploration and things that need to get developed to kind of start to fulfill those full business use cases. But as Joe mentioned, this is the first phase where you have to start getting that adoption and that interest. And often people who are these early adopters, who are developers, who are interested in it, the technology for the technology's sake, this is the time where folks like that like to jump in, because it's still a very early technology, but I think it is the future of where these systems have to go, with these sort of declarative multi-app models, not this single app mindset where you expect to take over the whole screen.
So when is the next hackathon? Have you guys thought about that? Or
I'm still recovering from the last hackathon. We've had two now at this point. We had one at the beginning of January, actually in person, back when that was a thing, at the Pluto offices in Seattle. And then we had this one, you know, virtual a couple weeks ago. And the feedback from both of them was incredibly valuable. It was, here's a pile of stuff that needs to be added to Aardvark or changed about Aardvark to make it easier to develop for, or to fill in this hole that makes it easy to make a gadget that does this, so that all the anybody who wants that to do that and a gadget can do it in a straightforward way. So I have a list of those things that I'm working through after the hackathon. And, you know, that's been tremendously valuable. But when you work on something mostly by yourself over a long period of time, it's hard to keep perspective on exactly what the most important thing is to do next. And this hackathon has re-energized that. It's really clued me into a set of things that I hadn't really been thinking about, because the way that I use Aardvark might not be the same as the way that a developer who's not working on, you know, the core guts of the system is using it. So that's what I'm working on right now. I don't know when the next hackathon will happen. I'd like to see some gadgets actually get up and running outside of a hackathon, so they have a little bit more time to settle and, you know, become a little bit more polished before we do that. So there are some examples, and probably build a lot of infrastructure and core technology through that process that then will serve the next hackathon, so that it will be easier for people to get up and running.
We actually had a previous episode where we talked about hackathons, you know, virtual hackathons. In this case, you held it kind of over a weekend in real time, I guess everybody communicating through Slack or video or what have you. Maybe more for Forrest, have you guys thought about having a hackathon sort of like how DevPost would do it, where you find out what the tools are up front, the resources, what the goal is, and then you have like a month to go do it, and you sort of check in every weekend and make sure people are making progress? Do you have any thoughts on that, comparing those two models?
We haven't really explored that too much, although I will say that the real power of how we approached this last one, which was the sort of intense over the weekend one, was the sort of social energy you get. We all are really challenged right now because of COVID and our amount of interactions with other people. And so having an opportunity where you can kind of have an excuse to spend the whole weekend hanging out with other people that you know, meeting new people, mm-hmm. that's a hard, meeting new people, what's that thing? I forgot what that was. know, so this opportunity to have that intensity is actually really, really helpful right now. And so I could imagine doing a longer scale hackathon. We could try something like that. But for the purposes of where we're at in the technology and kind of where we're all at because of COVID, that intensity was great because we were able to just hop on and just spend time with each other. And even while people are coding, just have an open line of communication where we could just hear each other. And you mostly just hear mechanical keyboards typing. But it was great because it was getting a chance to spend the weekend feeling like you're present with other people, more so than I think most of us have felt for a long time.
How large is Project Aardvark? How many developers are involved in it? And are there ways for people to get involved?
There are plenty of ways for people to get involved. The source code's all up on GitHub, and I would certainly welcome pull requests. Aardvark is mostly me at this point. Mm-hmm. I had some contributions from some folks at Pluto who have really helped out with a few bits of core tech here and there, some examples, and gadgets. And then there are a number of people through the hackathon, and well, mainly through the hackathon or the attention around the hackathon, that are messing around with different gadgets. But there are a huge number of things that people could do to help out, including using it and giving us feedback, writing gadgets, and deploying those for other people to use. If you do end up writing a gadget, please send me the URL. I'll add it to that list that Forrest mentioned. Digging into the core code and contributing there and fixing bugs or adding, like, someone showed up at the hackathon that I know through OpenXR who said it doesn't support Linux. It should support Linux. And I said, you should send me a pull request. So I'm happy to take those. Like, anybody who wants to contribute on that side, I'm happy to take that effort. Or fixing bugs or providing feedback or helping with the documentation, recording videos, like any of those things would be helpful. Because spinning up that initial, you know, ecosystem is where we're at. And there are so many different ways to contribute to that effort.
Well, we're coming to the end of another episode here. I really want to thank Joe and Forrest for joining us today. You know, just a reminder to all of our listeners, there is so much happening within XR, whether it's hardware, software, business, challenges and opportunities both exist. And I really hope that some of our listeners participate in the project. It'd be fantastic to see what folks come up with. I'll start with Forrest. Just closing comments. What's the best way for someone to get in touch with you and let us know if you have, if you'd like us to do anything for you?
Yeah, you can get in touch with me. Pretty easy to find. I'm Forrest Gibson at Twitter and just about every other social media platform. You can send me an email at forrest@plutovr.com. And, you know, if you are in VR and you have a SteamVR enabled headset, feel free to reach out to me. You can download Pluto and my username is Forrest Gibson. So give me a call.
You can reach me at my email address, joe@programmerjoe.com. My blog itself hasn't been updated recently, but the email address still works. On the Aardvark Slack is actually a great way to reach me.
Fantastic. Once again, thank you very much, and we'll follow the project.
Thank you.
Good day.
Thank you.